Dad is touching my shoulder. Come on, Francis, you have to take care of your little brothers. Mam is slumped on the edge of the bed, making small crying sounds like a bird. Grandma's pulling on her shawl. She says, I'll go down to Thompson the undertaker about the coffin and the carriage. The St. Vincent de Paul Society will surely pay for that, God knows. She goes out the door. Dad stands facing the wall over the fire, beating on his thighs with his fists, sighing, Och, och, och. Dad frightens me with his och, och, och. And Mam frightens me with her small bird sounds. And I don't know what to do, though I wonder if anyone will light the fire in the grate, so that we can have tea and bread, because it's a long time since we had the porridge. If Dad would move away from the fireplace, I could light the fire myself. All you need is paper, a few bits of coal or turf, and a match. He won't move, so I try to go around his legs while he's beating on his thighs, but he notices me and wants to know why I'm trying to light the fire. I tell him we're all hungry, and he lets out a crazy laugh. Hungry, he says. Och, Francis, your wee brother Oliver is dead. Your wee sister is dead, and your wee brother is dead. He picks me up and hugs me so hard I cry out. Then Malachy cries, my mother cries, Dad cries, I cry. But Eugene stays quiet. Then Dad sniffles. We'll have a feast. Come on, Francis. He tells my mother we'll be back in a while, but she has Malachy and Eugene on her lap in the bed and she doesn't look up. He carries me through the streets of Limerick, and we go from shop to shop with him asking for food or anything they can give to a family that has 2 children dead in a year, one in America, one in Limerick, and in danger of losing 3 more for the want of food and drink. Most shopkeepers shake their heads. Sorry for your troubles, but you could go to the St. Vincent de Paul Society or get the public assistance. Dad says he's glad to see the spirit of Christ alive in Limerick, and they tell him they don't need the likes of him with his northern accent to be telling them about Christ, and he should be ashamed of himself, dragging a child around like that, like a common beggar, a tinker, a knacker. A few shopkeepers give bread, potatoes, tins of beans, and Dad says, we go home now, and you boys can eat something. But we meet Uncle Pa Keating, and he tells Dad he's very sorry for his troubles, and would Dad like to have a pint in this pub here? There are men sitting in this pub with great glasses of black stuff before them. Uncle Pa Keating and Dad have the black stuff too. They lift their glasses carefully and slowly drink. There is creamy white stuff on their lips, which they lick with little sighs. Uncle Pa gets me a bottle of lemonade, and Dad gives me a piece of bread, and I don't feel hungry anymore. Still, I wonder how long we'll sit here with Malachy and Eugene hungry at home, hours from the porridge, which Eugene didn't eat anyway. Dad and Uncle Pa drink their glass of black stuff and have another. Uncle Pa says, Frankie, this is the pint. This is the staff of life. This is the best thing for nursing mothers and for those who are long weaned. He laughs, and Dad smiles, and I laugh because I think that's what you're supposed to do when Uncle Pa says something. He doesn't laugh when he tells the other men about Oliver dying. The other men tip their hats to Dad. Sorry for your troubles, mister, and surely you'll have a pint. Dad says yes to the pints, and soon he's singing Roddy McCauley and Kevin Barry, and song after song I never heard before, and crying over his lovely little girl, Margaret, that died in America, and his little boy, Oliver, dead beyond in the City Home Hospital. It frightens me the way he yells and cries and sings, and I wish I could be at home with my 3 brothers, no, my 2 brothers, and my mother. The man behind the bar says to Dad, I think now, mister, you've had enough. We're sorry for your troubles, but you have to take that child home to his mother that must be heartbroken by the fire. Dad says, One more pint, just one, eh? And the man says, no. Dad shakes his fist. I did me bit for Ireland. And when the man comes out and takes Dad's arm, Dad tries to push him away. Uncle Pa says, come on now, Malachy, stop the blackguarding. You have to go home to Angela. You have a funeral tomorrow and the lovely children waiting for you. But Dad struggles till a few men push him out into the darkness. Uncle Pa stumbles out with the bag of food. Come on, he says. We'll go back to your room. Dad wants to go to another place for a pint, but Uncle Pa says he has no more money. Dad says he'll tell everyone his sorrows and they'll give him pints. Uncle Pa says that's a disgraceful thing to do, and Dad cries on his shoulder. You're a good friend, he tells Uncle Pa. He cries again, till Uncle Pa pats him on the back. It's terrible, terrible, says Uncle Pa. But you'll get over this in time. Dad straightens up and looks at him. Never, he says. Never. Next day, we rode to the hospital in a carriage with a horse. They put Oliver in a white box that came with us in the carriage, and we took him to the graveyard. They put the white box into a hole in the ground and covered it with earth. My mother and Aunt Aggie cried. Grandma looked angry. Dad, Uncle Pat Keating, and Uncle Pat Sheehan looked sad but did not cry. And I thought that if you're a man, you can cry only when you have the black stuff that is called the pint. I did not like the jackdaws that perched on trees and gravestones, and I did not want to leave Oliver with them. I threw a rock at a jackdaw that waddled over towards Oliver's grave. Dad said I shouldn't throw rocks at jackdaws. They might be somebody's soul. I didn't know what a soul was, but I didn't ask him because I didn't care. Oliver was dead, and I hated jackdaws. I'd be a man someday, and I'd come back with a bag of rocks, and I'd leave the graveyard littered with dead jackdaws. The morning after Oliver's burial, Dad went to the Labour Exchange to sign and collect the week's dole, 19 shillings and 6 pence. He said he'd be home by noon, that he'd get coal and make a fire, that we'd have rashers and eggs and tea in honour of Oliver, that we might even have a sweet or two. He wasn't home by noon or one or two, and we boiled and ate the few potatoes the shopkeepers had given the day before. He wasn't home any time before the sun went down that day in May. There was no sign of him till we heard him, long after the pubs closed, rolling along Windmill Street singing, when all around a vigil keep, the west's asleep, the west's asleep, alas and well may Erin weep, when Connacht lies in slumber deep, there lake and plain smile fair and free, mid rocks their guardian chivalry. Sing, oh, let man learn liberty from crashing wind and lashing sea. He stumbled into the room, hanging onto the wall, a snot oozed from his nose, and he wiped it away with the back of his hand. He tried to speak. These children should be in bed. Listen to me. Children, go to bed. Mam faced him. These children are hungry. Where's the dole money? We'll get fish and chips so they'll have something in their bellies when they go to sleep. She tried to stick her hands into his pockets, but he pushed her away. Have respect, he said. Respect in front of children. She struggled to get at his pockets. Where's the money? The children are hungry. You mad old bastard. Did you drink all the money again, just what you did in Brooklyn? He blubbered. Ach, poor Angela, and poor wee Margaret, and poor wee Oliver. He staggered to me and hugged me, and I smelled the drink I used to smell in America. My face was wet from his tears and his spit and his snot, and I was hungry, and I didn't know what to say when he cried all over my head. Then he let me go and hug Malachy, still going on about the wee sister and the wee brother cold on the ground, and how we all have to pray and be good, how we have to be obedient and do what our mother tells us. He said we have our troubles, but it's time for Malachy and me to start school because there's nothing like an education. It will stand to you in the end. And you have to get ready to do your bit for Ireland. Mam says she can't spend another minute in that room in Windmill Street. She can't sleep with the memory of Oliver in that room, Oliver in the bed, Oliver playing on the floor, Oliver sitting on Dad's lap by the fire. She says it's not good for Eugene to be in that place, that a twin will suffer more over the loss of his brother than even a mother can understand. There's a room going on Hartstone Street with two beds instead of the one we have here for the six of us. No, the five of us. We're getting that room. And to make sure, she's going to the Labour Exchange on Thursday to stand in the queue to take the dole money the minute it's handed to Dad. He says she can't do that. He'd be disgraced with the other men. The Labour Exchange is a place for men, not for women taking the money from under their noses. She says, pity about you. If you didn't squander the money in the pubs, I wouldn't have to follow you the way I did in Brooklyn. He tells her he'll be shamed forever. She says she doesn't care. She wants that room in Hartstone Street, a nice, warm, comfortable room with a lavatory down the hall, like the one in Brooklyn, a room without fleas and the dampness that kills. She wants that room because it's on the same street as Leamy's National School. And Malachy and I can come home at the dinner hour, which is noon, for a cup of tea and a cut of fried bread. On Thursday, Mam follows Dad to the Labour Exchange. She marches in behind him, and when the man pushes the money toward Dad, she takes it. The other men in the dole nudge each other and grin, and Dad is disgraced because a woman is never supposed to interfere with a man's dole money. He might want to put sixpence on a horse or have a pint. And if all the women start acting like Mam, the horses will stop running and Guinness will go broke. But she has the money now, and we move to Hartstone Street. Then she carries Eugene in her arms, and we go up the street to Leamy's National School. The headmaster, Mr. Scallon, says we are to return on Monday with a composition book, a pencil, and a pen with a good nib on it. We are not to come to school with ringworm or lice, and our noses are to be blown at all times, not on the floor, that spreads consumption, or on our sleeves, but in a handkerchief or a clean rag. He asks us if we are good boys, and when we say we are, he says, good Lord, what's this? Are they Yanks or what? Mam tells him about Margaret and Oliver, and he says, Lord above, there's great suffering in the world. Anyway, we put the little fella Malachy in the infants class and his brother in first class. They're in the same room with one master. Monday morning, then, 9 o'clock prompt. The boys in Leamy's want to know why we talk like that. Are ye Yanks or what? And when we tell them we came from America, they want to know, are ye gangsters or cowboys? A big boy sticks his face up to mine. I'm asking ye a question, he says. Are ye gangsters or cowboys? I tell him I don't know. And when he pokes his finger into my chest, Malachy says, I'm a gangster. Frank's a cowboy. The big boy says, your little brother is smart, and you're a stupid Yank. The boys around him are excited. Fight, they yell. Fight. And he pushes me so hard I fall. I want to cry, but the blackness comes over me the way it did with Freddie Leibowitz, and I rush at him, kicking and punching. I knock him down and try to grab his hair to bang his head on the ground, but there's a sharp sting across the back of my legs and I'm pulled away from him. Mr. Benson, the master, has me by the ear, and he's whacking me across the legs. You little hooligan, he says. Is that the kind of behavior you brought from America? Well, by God, you'll behave yourself before I'm done with you. He tells me hold out one hand, and then the other, and hits me with his stick, once on each hand. Go home now, he says, and tell your mother what a bad boy you were. You're a bad Yank. Say after me, I'm a bad boy.
I'm a bad boy.
Now say, I'm a bad Yank.
I'm a bad Yank.
Malachy says,
he's not a bad boy. It's that big boy. He said we were cowboys and gangsters.
Is that what you did, Heffernan?
I was only joking, sir.
No more joking, Heffernan. It's not their fault that they're Yanks.
"'Tisn't, sir.'
"'And you, Heffernan, should get down on your two knees every night "'and thank God you're not a Yank, "'for if you were, Heffernan, "'you'd be the greatest gangster on two sides of the Atlantic. "'Al Capone would be coming to you for lessons. "'You're not to be bothering these two Yanks anymore, Heffernan.'
"'I won't, sir.'
"'And if you do, Heffernan, I'll hang your pelt on the wall. "'Now go home, all of ye.'
"'There are seven masters in Leamy's National School, "'and they all have leather straps, canes, black thorn sticks. "'They hit you with the sticks on the shoulders, the back, the legs, "'and especially the hands. "'If they hit you on the hands, it's called a slap. "'They hit you if you're late.' If you have a leaky nib on your pen, if you laugh, if you talk, and if you don't know things. They hit you if you don't know why God made the world, if you don't know the patron saint of Limerick, if you can't recite the Apostles' Creed, if you can't add 19 to 47, if you can't subtract 19 from 47, if you don't know the chief towns and products of the 32 counties of Ireland. If you can't find Bulgaria on the wall map of the world that's blotted with spit, snot, and blobs of ink thrown by angry pupils expelled forever. They hit you if you can't say your name in Irish, if you can't say the Hail Mary in Irish, if you can't ask for the lavatory pass in Irish. It helps to listen to the big boys ahead of you. They can tell you about the master you have now, what he likes and what he hates. One master will hit you if you don't know that Eamon de Valera is the greatest man that ever lived. Another master will hit you if you don't know that Michael Collins was the greatest man that ever lived. Mr. Benson hates America, and you have to remember to hate America, or he'll hit you. Mr. O'Dea hates England, and you have to remember to hate England, or he'll hit you. If you ever say anything good about Oliver Cromwell, they'll all hit you. Even if they slap you six times in each hand with the ash plant or the black thorn with the knobs, you must not cry. You'll be a sissy. There are boys who might jeer at you and mock you on the street, but even they have to be careful, because the day will come when the master hits and slaps them, and they have to keep the tears behind their eyes or be disgraced forever. Some boys say it is better to cry because that pleases the masters. If you don't cry, the masters hate you, because you've made them look weak before the class, and they promise themselves the next time they have you up, they'll draw tears, or blood, or both. Big boys in fifth class tell us Mr. O'Dea likes to get you in front of the class so that he can stand behind you, pinch your sideburns, which are called Cossacks, pull up on them. Up, up, he says, till you're on tiptoe and the tears are filling your eyes. You don't want the boys in the class to see you cry, but pulling on the Cossacks makes the tears come whether you like it or not, and the master likes that. Mr. O'Dea is the one master who can always bring the tears and the shame. It's better not to cry, because you have to stick with the boys in the school, and you never want to give the masters any satisfaction. If the master hits you, there's no use complaining to your father or mother. They always say, "You deserve it. Don't be a baby." I know Oliver is dead, and Maliki knows Oliver is dead, but Eugene is too small to know anything. When he wakes in the morning, he says, "Ollie, Ollie," and toddles around the room, looking under the beds. Or he climbs up on the bed by the window and points to children on the street, especially children with fair hair like him and Oliver. "Ollie, Ollie," he says, and Mam picks him up, sobs, hugs him. He struggles to get down because he doesn't want to be picked up and hugged. He wants to find Oliver. Dad and Mam tell him Oliver is in heaven playing with angels, and we'll all see him again someday, but he doesn't understand because he's only two and doesn't have the words, and that's the worst thing in the whole world. Maliki and I play with him. We try to make him laugh. We make funny faces. We put pots in our heads and pretend to let them fall off. We run across the room and pretend to fall down. We take him to the People's Park to see the lovely flowers,
play with dogs, roll in the grass. He sees small children with fair hair like Oliver. He doesn't say Ollie anymore. He only points. Dad says Eugene is lucky to have brothers like Malachi and me, because we help him forget, and soon, with God's help, he'll have no memory of Oliver at all. He died anyway. 6 months after Oliver went, we woke on a mean November morning, and there was Eugene cold in the bed beside us. Dr. Troy came and said that child died of pneumonia, and why wasn't he in the hospital long ago? Dad said he didn't know, Mam said she didn't know, and Dr. Troy said that's why children die. People don't know. He said if Malachi or I showed the slightest sign of a cough, or the faintest rattle in the throat, we were to be brought to him no matter what time of day or night. We were to be kept dry at all times because there seemed to be a bit of a weakness in the chest in this family. He told Mam he was very sorry for her troubles, and he'd give her a prescription for something to ease the pain of the days to come. He said God was asking too much, too damn much. Grandma came over to our room with Aunt Aggie. She washed Eugene, and Aunt Aggie went to shop for a little white gown and a set of rosary beads. They dressed him in a white gown and laid him on the bed by the window where he used to look out for Oliver. They placed his hands on his chest, one hand on top of the other, bound in the little white rosary beads. Grandma brushed the hair back from his eyes and forehead, and she said, "Doesn't he have lovely, soft, silky hair?" Mam went to the bed and pulled a blanket over his legs to keep him warm. Grandma and Aunt Aggie looked at each other and said nothing. Dad stood at the end of the bed, beating his fists against his thighs, talking to Eugene, telling him, "Ach, it was the River Shannon that harmed you, the dampness from that river that came and took you and Oliver." Grandma said, "Will you stop that? You're making the whole house nervous." She took Dr. Troy's prescription and told me to run over to O'Connor the chemist for the pills, that there would be no charge due to the kindness of Dr. Troy. Dad said he'd come with me, that we go to the Jesuit church and say our prayer for Margaret and Oliver and Eugene, all happy in heaven. The chemist gave us the pills. We stopped to say the prayers. And when we returned to the room, Grandma gave Dad the money to bring a few bottles of stout from the pub. Mam said, "No, no." But Grandma said, "He doesn't have the pills to ease him, God help us, and a bottle of stout will be some small comfort." Then she told him he'd have to go to the undertaker tomorrow to bring the coffin back in a carriage. She told me go with my father and make sure he didn't stay in the pub all night and drink all the money. Dad said, "Ach, Frankie shouldn't be in pubs." And she said, "Then don't stay there." He put on his cap, and we went to South's pub, and he told me at the door I could go home now, that he'd be home after one pint. I said, "No." And he said, "Don't be disobedient. Go home to your poor mother." And I said, "No." And he said I was a bad boy, and God would be displeased. I said I wasn't going home without him, and he said, "Ach, what is the world coming to?" He had one quick pint of porter in the pub, and we went home with the bottles of stout. Pat Keating was in our room, with a small bottle of whiskey and bottles of stout, and Uncle Pat Sheehan brought two bottles of stout for himself. Uncle Pat sat on the floor, with his arms around his bottles, and he kept saying, "They're mine, they're mine," for fear they'd be taken from him. People who were dropped on their heads always worry someone will steal their stout. Grandma said, "All right, Pat, drink your stout yourself. No one will bother you." She and Aunt Aggie sat on the bed by Eugene. Pat Keating sat at the kitchen table, drinking his stout and offering everyone a sip of his whiskey. Mam took her pills and sat by the fire with Malachi in her lap. She kept saying Malachi had hair like Eugene, and Aunt Aggie said no, he did not, till Grandma drove her elbow into Aunt Aggie's chest and told her, "Shut up." Dad stood against the wall, drinking his stout between the fireplace and the bed with Eugene. Pat Keating told stories, and the big people laughed, even though they didn't want to laugh.
or they weren't supposed to laugh in the presence of a dead child.
He said when he was in the English army in France, the Germans sent gas over, which made him so sick they had to take him to the hospital. They kept him in the hospital a while and then sent him back to the trenches. English soldiers were sent home, but they didn't give a fiddler's fart about the Irish soldiers, whether they lived or died. Instead of dying, Pa made a vast fortune. He said he solved one of the great problems of trench warfare. In the trenches, it was so wet and muddy, they had no way of boiling the water for the tea. He said to himself, "Jesus, I have all this gas in my system, and 'tis a great pity to waste it." So, he shoved the pipe up his arse, lit a match to it, and there in a second he had a fine flame ready to boil water in any billy can. Tommies came running from trenches all around when they heard the news, and they gave him any amount of money if he'd let them boil water. He made so much money he was able to bribe the generals to let him out of the army, and off he went to Paris, where he had a fine time drinking wine with artists and models. He had such a high time of it, he spent all his money, and when he came back to Limerick, the only job he could get was in the gas works, shoveling coal into the furnaces. He said there was so much gas in his system now, he could supply light to a small town for a year. Aunt Aggie sniffed and said that was not a proper story to be telling in the presence of a dead child, and Grandma said it was better to have a story like that than to be sitting around with a long face. Uncle Pat Sheehan, sitting on the floor with his stout, said he was going to sing a song. "More power to you," said Pat Keating, and Uncle Pat sang "The Road to Rasheen." He kept saying, "Rasheen, Rasheen, Mavour Neen Mean," and the song made no sense because his father dropped him on his head long ago, and every time he sang that song he had different words. Grandma said that was a fine song, and Pat Keating said Caruso better look over his shoulder. Dad went over to the bed in the corner where he slept with Mam. He sat on the edge, put his bottle on the floor, covered his face with his hands and cried. He said, "Frank, Frank, come here." And I had to go to him so that he could hug me the way Mam was hugging Malachy. Grandma said, "We better go now and sleep a bit before the funeral tomorrow." They each knelt by the bed and said a prayer and kissed Eugene's forehead. Dad put me down, stood up, and nodded to them as they left. When they were gone, he lifted each of the stout bottles to his mouth and drained it. He ran his finger inside the whiskey bottle and licked it. He turned down the flame in the paraffin oil lamp on the table and said it was time for Malachy and me to be in bed. We'd have to sleep with him and Mam that night, as little Eugene would be needing the bed for himself. It was dark in the room now, except for the sliver of streetlight that fell on Eugene's lovely, soft, silky hair. Dad lights the fire in the morning, makes the tea, toasts the bread in the fire. He brings Mam's toast and tea, but she waves it away and turns to the wall. He brings Malachy and me to Eugene, to kneel and say a prayer. He says the prayers of one child are worth more in heaven than the prayers of 10 cardinals and 40 bishops. He shows us how to bless ourselves. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, Amen. And he says, "Dear God, this is what you want, isn't it? You want my son Eugene. You took his brother Oliver. You took his sister Margaret. I'm not supposed to question that, am I? Dear God above, I don't know why children have to die, but that is your will. You told the river to kill, and the Shannon killed. Could you at last be merciful? Could you leave us the children we have? That is all we ask. Amen." He helps Malachy and me wash our heads and feet, so that we'll be clean for Eugene's funeral. We have to be very quiet, even when he hurts us cleaning our ears with the corner of the towel we brought from America. We have to be quiet because Eugene is there with his eyes closed, and we don't want him to be waking up and looking out the window for Oliver. Grandma comes and tells Mam she has to get up.
There are children dead, she says, but there are children alive and they need their mother. She brings Mam a little tea in a mug to wash down the pills that ease the pain. Dad tells Grandma it's Thursday and he has to go to the labor exchange for the dole and then down to the undertaker to bring the mourning carriage and the coffin. Grandma tells him, take me with him, but he says it's better for me to stay with Malachi so that I can pray for my little brother dead in the bed. Grandma says, is it codding me you are? Pray for a little child that's barely two and already playing with his little brother in heaven? You'll take your son with you, and he'll remind you this is no day for the pubs. She looks at him, and he looks at her, and he puts on his cap. At the labor exchange, we stand at the end of the queue, till a man comes from behind the counter and tells Dad he's very sorry for his troubles, and he should go ahead of everyone else on this sorrowful day. Men touch their caps and say they're sorry for his troubles, and some pat my head and give me pennies, 24 pennies, 2 shillings. Dad tells me I'm rich now, and I should buy myself a suite, while he goes into this place for a minute. I know this place is a pub, and I know he wants to get the black stuff that is called the pint, but I don't say anything, because I want to go to the shop next door for a piece of toffee. I chew my toffee till it melts and leaves my mouth all sweet and sticky. Dad is still in the pub, and I wonder if I should get another piece of toffee as long as he's in there with the pint. I'm about to give the money to the woman in the shop when my hand is slapped down and there's Aunt Aggie raging. Is this what you do, she says, on the day of your brother's funeral, gorging yourself on sweets? And where's that father of yours? He's in the pub. Of course he's in the pub. You out here stuffing yourself with sweets, and him in there getting himself into a staggering condition the day your poor little brother goes to the graveyard. She tells the shopwoman, just like his father, the same odd manner, the same old northern jaw. She tells me get into that pub and tell my father to stop the drinking and get the coffin in the carriage. She will not set foot inside the pub. For the drink is the curse of this poor, God-forsaken country. Dad is sitting at the back of the pub with a man who has a dirty face and hair growing out of his nose. They're not talking, but staring straight ahead, and their black pints are resting on a small white coffin on the seat between them. I know that's Eugene's coffin because Oliver had one like it, and I want to cry when I see the black pints on top of it. I'm sorry now I ever ate that toffee, and I wish I could take it out of my stomach and give it back to the woman in the shop, because it's not right to be eating toffee when Eugene is dead in the bed, and I'm frightened by the 2 black pints on his white coffin. The man with Dad is saying, no, mister, you can't leave a child's coffin in a carriage no more. I did that once, went in for a pint, and they robbed that little coffin out of the bloody carriage. Can you credit that? It was empty, thank God, but there you are. Desperate times we live in, desperate. The man with Dad lifts his pint and takes a long swallow. And when he puts his glass down, there's a hollow sound in the coffin. Dad nods at me. We'll be going in a minute, son. But when he goes to put his glass on the coffin after the long swallow, I push it away. That's Eugene's coffin. I'll tell Mam you put your glass on Eugene's coffin. Now, son, now, son. Dad, that's Eugene's coffin. The other man says, will we have another pint, mister? Dad says to me, wait outside another few minutes, Francis. No. Don't be a bad boy. No. The other man says, by Jesus, if that was my son, I'd kick his arse from here to the County Kerry. He have no right to be talking to his father in that manner on a sorrowful day. If a man can't have a pint the day of a funeral, what's the use of living at all, at all? Dad says, all right, we'll go. They finish their pints and wipe the wet brown stains off the coffin with their sleeves. The man climbs up to the driver's seat of the carriage, and Dad and I ride inside. He has the coffin on his lap, and he presses it against his chest. At home, our room is filled with big people, Mam, Grandma, Aunt Aggie, her husband Pat Keating, Uncle Pat Sheehan, Uncle Tom Sheehan, who's Mam's oldest brother, and who never came near us before because he hates people from the north of Ireland. Uncle Tom has his wife, Jane, with him. She's from Galway, and the people say she has the look of a Spaniard, and that's why no one in the family talks to her. The man takes the coffin from Dad, and when he brings it into the room, Mam moans, "Oh, no! Oh, God, no!" The man tells Grandma he'll be back in a while to take us to the graveyard. Grandma tells him he'd better not come back to this house in a drunken state, because this child that's gone to the graveyard suffered greatly and deserves a bit of dignity, and she won't put up with a driver that's drunk and ready to fall out of the high seat. The man says, "Missus, I drove dozens of children to the graveyard and never once fell out of any seat, high or low." The men are drinking stout from bottles again, and the women are sipping sherry from jam jars. Uncle Pat Sheehan tells everyone, "This is my stout, this is my stout." And Grandma said, "'Tis all right, Pat, no one will take your stout." Then he says he wants to sing The Road to Rasheen. To Pat Keating says, "No, Pat, you can't sing on the day of a funeral. You can sing the night before." But Uncle Pat keeps saying, "This is my stout, and I want to sing The Road to Rasheen." And everyone knows he talks like that because he was dropped in his head. He starts to sing his song, but stops when Grandma takes the lid off the coffin, and Mam sobs, oh, Jesus, will it ever stop? Will I be left with one child?" Mam is sitting on a chair at the head of the bed. She's stroking Eugene's hair and face and hands. She tells him that of all the children in the world, he was the sweetest and the most delicate and loving. She tells him 'tis a terrible thing to lose him, but isn't he in heaven now with his brother and his sister? And isn't that a comfort to us, knowing Oliver is no longer lonesome for his twin? Still, she puts her head down next to Eugene and cries so hard all the women in the room cry with her. She cries till Pat Keating tells her we have to go before the darkness falls, that we can't be in graveyards in the dark. Grandma whispers to Aunt Aggie, "Who'll put the child in the coffin?" And Aunt Aggie whispers, "I won't. That's the job for the mother." Uncle Pat hears them. "I'll put the child in the coffin," he says. He limps to the bed and places his arms around Mam's shoulders. She looks up at him, and her face is drenched. He says, "I'll put the child in the coffin, Angela." "Oh, Pat," she says. "Pat." "I can do it," he says. "Sure, he's only a small child, and I never lifted a small child before in me life. I never had a small child in me arms. I won't drop him, Angela, I won't. Honest to God, I won't." "I know you won't, Pat. I know you won't. I lift him, and I won't be singing The Road to Rasheen." "I know you won't, Pat," Mam says. Pat pulls down the blanket Mam put there to keep Eugene warm. Eugene's feet are white and bright with little blue veins. Pat bends over, picks up Eugene and holds him against his chest. He kisses Eugene's forehead, and then everyone in the room kisses Eugene. He places Eugene in the coffin and steps back. We're all gathered around, looking at Eugene for the last time. Uncle Pat says, "See, I didn't drop him, Angela." And she touches his face. Aunt Aggie goes to the pub for the driver. He puts the lid on the coffin and screws it down. He says, "Who's coming in the carriage?" And takes the coffin to the carriage. There's room only for Mam and Dad, Malachy and me. Grandma says, "Ye go ahead to the graveyard and we'll wait here." I don't know why we can't keep Eugene. I don't know why they have to send him away with that man who puts his pint in the white coffin. I don't know why they had to send Margaret away, and Oliver. It's a bad thing to put my sister and my brothers in a box, and I wish I could say something to someone. The horse clop-clopped through the streets of Limerick. Malachy said, "Are we going to see Oliver?" And Dad said, "No, Oliver is in heaven." And don't ask me what heaven is, because I don't know.
Mam said, Heaven is a place where Oliver and Eugene and Margaret are happy and warm, and we'll see them there some day.
Maliki said, The horse did his doo-doo on the street, and there was a smell.
And Mam and Dad had to smile.
At the graveyard, the driver climbs down and opens the door of the carriage.
Give me that coffin, he says, and I'll carry it up to the grave.
He yanks at the coffin and stumbles.
Mam says, You're not carrying my child in the condition you're in.
She turns to Dad.
You carry him, she says.
Do what you like, says the driver. Do what you bloody well like, and he climbs up to his seat.
It's getting dark now, and the coffin seems whiter than ever in Dad's arms.
Mam takes our hands, and we follow Dad through the graves. The jackdaws are quiet in the trees, because their day is nearly over, and they have to rest so they can get up early in the morning and feed their babies.
Two men with shovels are waiting by a small open grave.
One man says, You're very late. Good thing this is a small job or we'd be gone.
He climbs into the grave.
Hand it to me, he says,
and Dad hands him the coffin.
The man sprinkles some straw and grass on the coffin, and as he climbs out, the other man shovels in the earth.
Mam lets out a long cry,
Oh, Jesus, Jesus!
And a jackdaw croaks in a tree.
I wish I had a rock to hit that jackdaw.
When the men finish shoveling in the earth, they wipe their foreheads and wait.
One says, Ah, well, now, there's usually a little something for the thirst that's in it.
Dad says, Oh, yes, yes, and gives them money.
They say, Sorry for your troubles, and they leave.
We make our way back to the carriage at the graveyard gate, but the carriage is gone.
Dad looks around in the darkness and comes back shaking his head.
Mam says, That driver is nothing but a dirty old drunkard. God forgive me.
It's a long walk from the graveyard to our room.
Mam tells Dad, These children need some nourishment, and you have money left from the doll this morning. If you're thinking of going to the pubs tonight, you can forget it. We're taking them to Nocton's, and they can have fish and chips and lemonade, for 'tisn't every day they bury a brother.
The fish and chips are delicious with vinegar and salt, and the lemonade is tart in our throats.
When we get home, the room is empty. There are empty stout bottles on the table, and the fire is out.
Dad lights the paraffin oil lamp, and you can see the hollow left in the pillow by Eugene's head.
You expect to hear him and see him toddling across the room, climbing up in the bed to look out the window for Oliver.
Dad tells Mam he's going for a walk.
She says, No. She knows what he's up to, that he can't wait to spend his last few shillings in the pub.
All right, he says.
He lights the fire, and Mam makes tea, and soon we're in bed.
Maliki and I are back in the bed where Eugene died. I hope he's not cold in that white coffin in the graveyard, though I know he's not there anymore because angels come to the graveyard and open the coffin, and he's far from the Shannon dampness that kills, up in the sky in heaven with Oliver and Margaret, where they have plenty of fish and chips and toffee and no aunts to bother you, where all the fathers bring home the money from the labour exchange, and you don't have to be running around to pubs to find them.
Mam says she can't spend another minute in that room in Hartstong Street.
She sees Eugene morning, noon and night. She sees him climbing the bed to look out at the street for Oliver, and sometimes she sees Oliver outside and Eugene inside, the two of them chatting away. She's happy they're chatting like that, but she doesn't want to be seeing and hearing them the rest of her life.
It's a shame to move when we're so near Leamy's National School, but if she doesn't move soon, she'll go out of her mind and wind up in the lunatic asylum.
We move to Roden Lane, on top of a place called Barrack Hill. There are six houses on one side of the lane, one on the opposite side. The houses are called Two Up, Two Down. Two rooms on top, two on the bottom. Our house is at the end of the lane, the last of the six. Next to our door is a small shed, a lavatory, and next to that, a stable. Mam goes to the St. Vincent de Paul Society to see if there's any chance of getting furniture. The man says he'll give us a docket for a table, two chairs and two beds. He says we'll have to go to a second-hand furniture shop down in the Irish town and haul the furniture home ourselves. Mam says we can use the pram she had for the twins, and when she says that, she cries. She wipes her eyes on her sleeves and asks the man if the beds we're getting are second-hand. He says, of course they are. And she says she's worried about sleeping in beds someone might have died in, especially if they had the consumption. The man says, I'm very sorry, but beggars can't be choosers. It takes us all day to haul the furniture and the pram from one end of Limerick to the other. There are four wheels in the pram, but one is bockety. It wants to go in a different direction. We have two beds, one sideboard with a mirror, a table, and two chairs. We're happy with the house. We can walk from room to room and up and down the stairs. You feel very rich when you can go up and down the stairs all day as much as you please. Dad lights the fire and Mam makes the tea. He sits at the table on one chair, she sits on the other, and Maliki and I sit on the trunk we brought from America. While we're drinking our tea, an old man passes our door with a bucket in his hand. He empties the bucket into the lavatory and flushes, and there's a powerful stink in our kitchen. Mam goes to the door and says, why are you emptying your bucket in our lavatory? He raises his cap to her. Your lavatory, Mrs. Ah, no. You're making a bit of a mistake there, ha-ha. This is not your lavatory. Sure isn't this the lavatory for the whole lane? You'll see passing your door here the buckets of 11 families, and I can tell you it gets very powerful here in the warm weather. Very powerful altogether. 'Tis December now, thank God, with a chill in the air, and Christmas around the corner, and the lavatory isn't that bad, but the day will come when you'll be calling for a gas mask. So good night to you, missus, and I hope you'll be happy in your house. Mam says, wait a minute, sir. Could you tell me who cleans this lavatory? Cleans? Ah, Jesus, that's a good one. Cleans, she says. Is it joking you are? These houses were built in the time of Queen Victoria herself, and if this lavatory was ever cleaned, it must have been done by someone in the middle of the night when no one was looking. And he shuffles up the lane, laughing away to himself. Mam comes back to her chair and her tea. We can't stay here, she says. That lavatory will kill us all with diseases. Dad says, we can't move again. Where will we get a house for 6 shillings a week? We'll keep the lavatory clean ourselves. We'll boil buckets of water and throw them in there. Oh, will we, says Mam. And where will we get the coal or turf or blocks to be boiling water? Dad says nothing. He finishes his tea and looks for a nail to hang on one picture. The man in the picture has a thin face. He wears a yellow skull cap and a black robe with a cross on his chest. Dad says he was a pope, Leo XIII, a great friend of the working man. He brought this picture all the way from America, where he found it thrown out by someone who had no time for the working man. Mam says he's talking a lot of bloody nonsense. And he says she shouldn't say bloody in front of the children. Dad finds a nail, but wonders how he's going to get it into the wall without a hammer. Mam says he could go borrow one from the people next door, but he says, you don't go around borrowing from people you don't know. He leans the picture against the wall and drives the nail with the bottom of a jam jar. The jam jar breaks and cuts his hand and a blob of blood falls in the Pope's head. He wraps his hand in a dish rag and tells Mam, quick, quick, wipe the blood off the Pope before it dries. She tries to wipe the blood away with her sleeve, but it's wool and spreads the blood to the whole side of the Pope's face is smeared. Dad says, Lord above, Angela, you've destroyed the Pope entirely. And she says, Ara, stop your whining. We'll get some paint to go over his face some day. And Dad says, he's the only Pope that was ever a friend to the working man. And what are we to say if someone from the St. Vincent de Paul Society comes in and sees blood all over him? Mam says, I don't know. It's your blood, "'Tis a sad thing when a man can't even drive a nail straight. "'It just goes to show how useless you are. "'You'd be better off digging fields, and anyway, I don't care. "'I have a pain in me back, and I'm going to bed.'
"'Och, what am I going to do?' Dad says.
"'Take down the Pope and hide him in the coal hole under the stairs where he won't be seen, "'and he'll be out of harm's way.'
"'I can't,' says Dad. "'It would be bad luck. "'Coal hole is no place for a Pope. "'When the Pope is up, he's up.'
"'Suit yourself,' says Mam.
"'I will,' says Dad.
"'This is our first Christmas in Limerick, "'and the girls are out in the lane, "'skipping rope and singing. "'Christmas is coming and the goose is getting fat. "'Please put the penny in the old man's hat.' If you haven't a penny, a halfpenny will do, and if you haven't a halfpenny, God bless you. Boys tease the girls and call out, May your mother have an accident abroad in the loo. Mam says she'd like to have a nice Christmas dinner. But what can you do when the Labour Exchange reduces the dole to 16 shillings after Oliver and Eugene died? You pay the rent of 6 shillings, you have 10 shillings left, and what use is that to 4 people? Dad can't get any work. He gets up early on weekdays, lights the fire, boils water for the tea, and his shaving mug. He puts on a shirt and attaches a collar with studs. He puts on his tie and his cap and goes to the Labour Exchange to sign for the dole. He will never leave the house without collar and tie. A man without collar and tie is a man with no respect for himself. You never know when the clerk at the Labour Exchange might tell you there's a job going at Rang's Flour Mills or the Limerick Cement Company. And even if it's a labouring job, what will they think of you if you appear without collar and tie? Bosses and foremen always show him respect and say they're ready to hire him, but when he opens his mouth and they hear the North of Ireland accent, they take a Limerick man instead. That's what he tells Mam by the fire, and when she says, Why don't you dress like a proper working man? He says he'll never give an inch, never let them know. And when she says, Why can't you try to talk like a Limerick man? He says he'll never sink that low. And the greatest sorrow of his life is that his sons are now afflicted with the Limerick accent. She says, Sorry for your troubles, and I hope that's all you'll ever have. And he says that someday, with God's help, we'll get out of Limerick and far from the Shannon that kills. I ask Dad what afflicted means, and he says, Sickness, son, and things that don't fit. When he's not looking for work, Dad goes for long walks, miles into the country. He asks farmers if they need any help, that he grew up on a farm and could do anything. If they hire him, he goes to work right away with his cap on and his collar and tie. He works so hard and long, the farmers have to tell him to stop. They wonder how a man can work through a long, hot day with no thought of food or drink. Dad smiles. He never brings home the money he earns on farms. That money seems to be different from the dole, which is supposed to be brought home. He takes the farm money to the pub and drinks it. If he's not home when the Angelus rings at 6 o'clock, Mam knows he had a day of work. She hopes he might think of his family and pass the pub even once, but he never does. She hopes he might bring home something from the farm, potatoes, cabbage, turnips, carrots, but he'll never bring home anything because he'd never stoop so low as to ask a farmer for anything. Mam says 'tis all right for her to be begging at the St. Vincent de Paul Society for a docket for food, but he can't stick a few spuds in his pocket. He says it's different for a man. You have to keep the dignity, wear your collar and tie, keep up the appearance, and never ask for anything. Mam says, I hope it keeps fine for you. When the farm money is gone, he rolls home singing and crying over Ireland and his dead children, mostly about Ireland. If he sings Roddy McCauley, it means he had only the price of a pint or two. If he sings Kevin Barry, it means he had a good day, that he is now falling down drunk and ready to get us out of bed, line us up, and make us promise to die for Ireland, unless Mam tells him leave us alone or she'll brain him with the poker. Ah, you wouldn't do that, Angela. I would and more. You'd better stop the nonsense and go to bed. Bed, bed, bed. What's the use of going to bed? If I go to bed, I'll only have to get up again, and I can't sleep in a place where there's a river sending poison to us in mist and fog. He goes to bed, pounds the wall with his fist, sings a woeful song, falls asleep. He's up at daylight, because no one should sleep beyond the dawn. He wakes Malachi and me, and we're tired from being kept up the night before with his talking and singing. We complain and say we're sick, we're tired. But he pulls back the overcoats that cover us and forces us out on the floor. It's December and it's freezing, and we can see our breath. We pee into the bucket by the bedroom door and run downstairs for the warmth of the fire Dad has already started. We wash our faces and hands in a basin that sits under the water tap by the door. The pipe that leads to the tap has to be held to the wall by a piece of twine looped around a nail. Everything around the tap is damp, the floor, the wall, the chair the basin sits on. The water from the tap is icy, and our fingers turn numb. Dad says, this is good for us, it will make men of us. He throws the icy water on his face and neck and chest to show there's nothing to fear. We hold our hands to the fire for the heat that's in it, but we can't stay there long because we have to drink our tea and eat our bread and go to school. Dad makes us say grace before meals and grace after meals, and he tells us be good boys at school because God is watching every move, and the slightest disobedience will send us straight to hell, where we'll never have to worry about the cold again. And he smiles. 2 weeks before Christmas, Malachi and I come home from school in a heavy rain, and when we push in the door, we find the kitchen empty. The table and chairs and trunk are gone, and the fire is dead in the grate. The Pope is still there. That means we haven't moved again. Dad would never move without the Pope. The kitchen floor is wet, little pools of water all around, and the walls are twinkling with the damp. There's a noise upstairs, and when we go up, we find Dad and Mam and the missing furniture. It's nice and warm there with the fire blazing in the grate, Mam sitting in the bed, and Dad reading the Irish Press and smoking a cigarette by the fire. Mam tells us there was a terrible flood, that the rain came down the lane and poured in under our door. They tried to stop it with rags, but they only turned sopping wet and let the rain in. People emptying their buckets made it worse, and there was a sickening stink in the kitchen. She thinks we should stay upstairs as long as there's rain. We'll be warm through the winter months, and then we can go downstairs in the springtime if there's any sign of a dryness in the walls or the floor. Dad says it's like going away on our holidays to a warm, foreign place like Italy. That's what we'll call the upstairs from now on. Italy. Malachi says the Pope is still on the wall downstairs, and he's going to be all cold, and couldn't we bring him up? But Mam says, no. He's going to stay where he is because I don't want him on the wall glaring at me in the bed. Isn't it enough that we dragged him all the way from Brooklyn to Belfast to Dublin to Limerick? All I want now is a little peace, ease, and comfort. Mam takes Malachi and me to the St. Vincent de Paul Society to stand in the queue and see if there's any chance of getting something for the Christmas dinner. A goose or a ham. But the man says everyone in Limerick is desperate this Christmas. He gives her a docket for groceries at McGrath's shop and another one for the butcher. No goose, says the butcher. No ham. No fancy item when you bring the docket from the St. Vincent de Paul. What you can have now, missus, is black pudding and tripe, or a sheep's head, or a nice pig's head. No ham and a pig's head, missus. Plenty of meat, and the children love it. Slice that cheek, slather it with mustard, and you're in heaven. Though, I suppose they wouldn't have the likes of that in America, where they're mad for the steak, and all classes of poultry flying, walking, or swimming itself. He tells Mam, no, she can't have boiled bacon or sausages, and if she has any sense, she'll take the pig's head before they're all gone the way the poor people of Limerick are clamouring for them. Mam says the pig's head isn't right for Christmas, and he says 'tis more than the Holy Family had in that cold stable in Bethlehem long ago. You wouldn't find them complaining if someone offered them a nice, fat pig's head. No, they wouldn't complain, says Mam, but they'd never eat the pig's head. They were Jewish.
And what does that have to do with it?